Well, that's a New Year tune. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind, here on WBAI with a little skip to our beat today. Dreams of Children by Shadow. Facts. Hey, with you today, you're bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And you know, you look out there and you wonder to yourself, how do people get by? How do they get by from one spot to the other? How do they? Sometimes the energy is very difficult. Some people live life as if they can lose anything, everything, at any given moment. Here's the picture. You feel compelled to work, work, work. You're obsessed by money, how you get money, how you keep money, how you make sure nobody takes your money away. You're very suspicious. You doubt everything that might take away your security in any form. You look for friends, groups, alliances of people who can support you, people who support each other. You try to get together. You join groups. But you don't really trust anybody that much. You just hope that they're trustworthy. Why so much fear? Why do some people doubt everything while other people are more trusting, more easy? Here's a good question. Is it natural to be suspicious? What's the fear all about? Maybe the ones who doubt and are suspicious are the true realists. Maybe those of us who don't worry so much are the misguided. If you think about it, in a jungle, you know, you can't get by in a jungle if you're not keeping your eyes open all the time. Yet there are playful animals, and then there are animals who are always watching. Today I want to look at the doubting people, the ones who know exactly how many exit doors there are in any room at any given time. They go into a big party, a ballroom, and they say, there are 6 ways out of here. Because they have a check. They know who could be trusted, who can't be trusted. Or they're checking for that at all times. Kind of people who seem to be essential for homeland security. Or are they? Because the very suspicious person very often shoots themselves in the foot. Because they keep their gun loaded all the time, you know. Because they're so ready to have something go wrong. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. I'm talking about doubting people today. I'm talking about people who live with great suspiciousness and not necessarily paranoia. I'm not talking about people who go over the edge. Here's an image I want you to have that seems to be the fundamental image of people who are real skeptics and real doubters. It goes as follows. At some point in life, you imagine you don't see it happening when it happens. You get blindsided. You suddenly lose everything. You don't have insurance. You have your insurance, and your insurance doesn't qualify. It's like having a flood suddenly come and take over your home. Nobody wants to be near you. You get lost out in the streets, and nobody really cares about you anymore. You're lost. Your mate and children reject you or they're gone. You're powerless. Now you have no money. Now you're alone. Now you can't even beg. You're standing in the street. You're like that photograph of that kid from Cambodia, you know, who's just like there with smoke and images on her face, you know, and she's been not damaged, but she's like a refugee and she's completely stark and lost. Now, little do you know that somebody's going to pick up that child, including the photographer who took the picture, right? And they're going to give her something. But you, in your belief system, those of you who are so suspicious and doubting, you could wind up like that child at any given moment. So you try to insure yourself against it. There's a wonderful expression that came that I remember as a kid. Someone said to me, you know, Armand, a man who doesn't trust himself can never trust anyone else. Is that the basis of it? Is that the basis of basic distrust? Is that what it's all about? So the basic fear of the person who doubts everything, and many of you know the person who doubts everything, they question everything. Is this really necessary? Do we have to have this? I remember I had one friend who I spoke to recently. He was about to buy Christmas presents for his kids, and I said, get one thing that's not practical, right? And he said, well, it has to be practical. It certainly can't be big because it just occupies too much space. Of having no support, the fear is that eventually there'll be no support, no guidance. You'll not be able to survive on your own. So your basic desire is to find security and support. The person who doubts is always looking for security. Maybe you could find it with friends. Maybe you could find it with organizations. Doubters are always loyal to ideas, systems, and beliefs, even to belief that all authorities should be questioned or defied in some way. Their beliefs may be rebellious, anti-authorian, even revolutionary. But once you get that in your head and you become a revolutionary, you can't step outside of it. You oppose everybody. You oppose everything. In any case, they'll typically fight with their beliefs for their beliefs more fiercely than they'll fight for themselves. And they'll defend their community or their family more tenaciously than they would or could even defend themselves. So this is a person who is a doubter, and the person who is a doubter usually will fight for their families. You know, they're big family people. They have wives and kids and a house, and they're going to defend it all. But they're not very good at taking care of themselves. Doubters believe that they do not possess the internal resources to handle life's challenges and vagaries alone. So they rely on structures, allies, beliefs, and supports about outside of themselves for guidance. But they don't have confidence in their own minds and judgments. They look for the judgment of other people. They look for authorities to give them, to tell them what's right, what's wrong. They tend to fear making important decisions. They resist having anybody else make decisions for them. So look at that conundrum. You know, on one hand, you don't want to make any important decisions, and they're notoriously indecisive. On the other hand, you can't have anybody else make the decision for you. They want to avoid being controlled, but they also are afraid of taking responsibility in a way that may put them in the line of fire. Now, this is why people who are doubters very often are rabble-rousers. You know, when rabble-rousers, that means they're going to rouse the rabble. They're going to get as many people as possible to be on their side, and they're going to do it by talking about something bad. You know, the government this, the government that. These are the ones who are the most verbally active in opposing by trying to get allies to oppose. They are out there and they're talking up resistance, but they're not too good at doing the resistance. These are not the ones who are going to lay down in the streets, you know, and say, I'm not going to do it. They're going to get other people. Maybe they'll do it with 40 or 50 people, but they won't do it alone. They won't be out front. In fact, they have a belief. It's the old Japanese adage, a blade of grass that grows too high always gets chopped off. So they believe that they have to stay under the radar in whatever their attack is. This is a very big social element here, because if you don't trust anybody and you're suspicious, you're going to tend to attract other people who are distrustful, and they're going to be with you, or you're going to attract somebody who's very dependent. If somebody feels lost in the world and powerless in the world, they see you, the one who doubts everything, as the strength. And they say, oh, look, he's so strong. He fights everything. He resists everything. He's so strong. He may not earn any money because he can't keep a job because he has such trouble with authority, but he's strong. And so I depend on him. So you would imagine that would be a good thing. If you're somebody who wants to have a relationship, there's someone who wants to have a family, and they want to protect you. But there's a funny thing about doubters. Even though they form the very strong bonds with their family and friends, they have a terror of being overwhelmed. So usually they get related to people who are not affectionate. So this is an interesting thing now. Here you are, a doubter. Nothing in the world. You feel completely lost. You don't know what to do with yourself. You're afraid that something is going to make you feel bad. You look for security. You look for help. You try to make it happen. Then you find a husband or a wife, and you find one. And now they're going to make you secure, but you're terrified of being overwhelmed. So you pick somebody who is non-affectionate, because you're afraid they're going to overwhelm you. So now you pick somebody who has the ability to stand aside from you, which makes them more likely to leave you. And you get the self-fulfilling prophecy. Isn't this good news? This is Armand DeMille with you with the positive mind. On the good side, these very same folks are the greatest ones to have in your army. You know, I mean, if you're going to be fighting a common battle, they are loyal to you. They will be there on your side. One wonders why. Why does somebody take a belief that it's better off to doubt everything, to be skeptical of everything, to look at everything with that strange eye? I see things. I mean, I see a lot of things. As many of you know, I have very good vision. I'm not talking about physical vision, but I could, you know, I could smell a change in the atmosphere from a far distance away. The other day I was getting on an airplane to come back to New York, and I saw somebody, one of the attendants, come running up the gangway while we were all waiting at the gate. And I said, aha, one of the crew members didn't show up. I don't know how I knew a crew member didn't show up, but it didn't look like any other kind of panic. And, you know, it was a crew member didn't show up. It was that look that says, aha, I don't have it all in order. But I don't worry about things too much. But here's the difference. I believe that no matter what the condition, I'm going to survive. I believe that if everything goes away and I wind up in the streets, I'm going to get through. I'm going to be able to get through one way or another. I'm a pretty smart guy, and I've got a lot of resources. So if you take everything away, okay, we'll start from here. We'll start from scratch. But if you don't have that belief, if you don't have that basic kind of, oh, I'm okay, I'll be okay, it's tough. Do you ever see anybody who hitchhikes through Europe or across the country? How many of you have done that? Didn't you always want to do it? Doesn't there some part of you that wants to just depend on your thumb and go across the country or go across? But how many fears? How many times did they tell you you've got to be careful, especially if you're a woman? If you're a woman and you get on the road, guys are going to abuse you and take advantage of you and so on and so forth. Do you know how few stories there are of hitchhikers being abused as much as there are fear of hitchhikers being abused? Because a hitchhiker becomes wily. They you know, they get a sense. They get a sense of, oh, this is a good scene, this is not a good scene. Here's my hand's on the door handle. I'm ready to leave at any point. Hitchhikers know how to do it. And so many people in the 60s and 70s hitchhiked throughout Europe and Asia. I had one friend who was a hitchhiker, Harvey Kaplan. I remember he started off in New York, and he said he wound up looking at the Taj Mahal after he woke up one morning after sleeping in a field in India. He said, so he opened his eyes and he looked up. He didn't know where he was. And there it was, the Taj. No fear. He wasn't a big guy. He was a small guy, you know. But he got through. He got into some tough situations, but he got through. If you believe in yourself being able to get through, and I don't mean if you're strong or big or you're a man, but if you believe in your ability to deal with it, you find that it's easier for you to not live as frightfully full of fright. So where does all this come from? Let's take a look at childhood. Let's imagine childhood. At some point in everybody's development, toddlers do a remarkable thing. Despite their tremendous dependency, which toddlers have, they begin to move away from their mothers to assert their independency and autonomy. In psychology, we call this the separation phase, is what we call it. Now, the most important ingredient that helps the child find the courage to separate from his or her mother is the presence of the father figure. It doesn't have to be a biological father, although it often is. It's the person who provides the discipline, structure, authority to the family in some way. If the father figure is present in a strong, consistent, and loving way, he provides the guidance and support for the child's bid for independence. He teaches the child about the ways of the world, what is safe and what is not, and he mirrors the child's own essential inner guidance and support. He supports the child's climbing a tree. He says, you know, you may fall down if you climb that tree. Try not to go too high, but give it a shot. Whereas opposed to if you don't have this person around, the best thing the mother could do is say, don't climb the tree, because I can't afford to watch out for you, and I certainly can't handle your broken bones if you fall. I'm alone trying to take care of the other kids. So having that father figure around is a great thing. He teaches the child about the ways of the world, what is safe and what is not. Of course, for most of us, the process has gone a little less than perfect, you know, because all of us had our rough spots, resulting in our own insecurities. But while everyone experiences it to some extent, the people who are perennial doubters are particularly fixated on the lack of security and what they could trust and what they can't trust. Furthermore, you know, if a doubting child perceives that the father's support for independence is insufficient, which very often happens, very often fathers compete with their sons. And they knock the kids, or they're afraid that their daughters are going to go out and get pregnant. So they keep knocking at the child's security, and they say it over and over again. You can't be trusted. Watch out. Don't go out there. Don't wear that skirt. Who do you think you are? Or they start telling the son, you're not a man. This is no good. You can't do this thing. You'll never make it. You're not that smart. Don't try. Look, you fail. They point out, you know, if you have a football game, they'll point out where you went wrong. They won't point out where you went right. If you have that kind of support, you got to watch out. Then you're in real fear of being overwhelmed. Now what happens is you turn away from your father, and this is a child who winds up being suspicious, which I'm describing. Now you hate your father, right? Now you can't stand your father. He's knocking at your knees all the time. And what you do is you turn to your mother for support. But because your mother is the kind of person who married somebody like your dad, she can't oppose him. But her revenge against your father is to get close to you. Now listen to this. This is kind of weird. So she makes a relationship with you. It's almost like a separate marriage. She gets close to you, and it could be a son or a daughter. And now you have to watch out for being overwhelmed. There you were in the first place. You couldn't be secure. And now you have this fear of being overwhelmed, over-engulfed by this mother who just needs you for her own security. So this heightens the child's need to keep their guard up. And leads to this deep loyalty, this deep ambivalence about trusting anybody. Anxiety, you don't trust anxiety. You don't trust nurturance. You don't trust closeness. So who do you marry? Somebody who can't get close, right? And somebody who can't nurture. Thus, doubters long for approval and closeness. But at the same time, they have the feeling they have to defend against it. And many of you know exactly what I'm talking about, especially if you're not one of them. You ever been in love with a doubter? It is a thing. I tell you. They want from you. And then if you show them any pure loving, they kind of exit. They kind of move away. They're terrified of being overwhelmed. To resolve the dilemma, doubters try to form allegiances with not their fathers, of course, so they look for father figures. Now, this is an interesting thing for me, Armand DeMille, here on the radio program, because, believe it or not, a lot of doubters form their allegiance with me. But then they feel ambivalent about it, you know, because, I mean, at first they say, you know, let me find somebody who's good, who's not strict, find somebody who's supportive. They have this kind of nice dedication and they feel really good about some father figure of some sort, which is a male authority figure of some sort, could be a boss. But then little by little, they keep the doubting going. I would love to warn everybody about my imperfections, you know, because when you look at me and you see perfection, or when you hear me and you hear this perfect attitude towards life, you're not hearing my imperfections. And what you're doing is you're listening for the perfection of my nurturing, loving, strong attitude, which I've got a good piece of. And then I've got this other piece of me that you don't know about that is not always like that. Ask the people that work for me. Is that true? It's true. It's true. But what happens when you're trying to trust somebody, you find a hero, and very often you find your heroes in radio. Gary Null, who used to be on the air, used to be with us at BAI. He was a hero to so many people. And then people would go to the farm, or they'd go to one of his lectures, or they'd try to approach him with a personal problem, and he might bark at them because he's under some kind of tension, and they would be shattered because they were trying to put too much in this one belief, you know? He used to get it a lot. He used to get a lot of, because he presented himself in a certain way, but then he had such popularity that people would, that he would very often repel people. He would say, don't come to my functions to talk to me about your sickness. You know, come here to learn. So, Armand DeMille here with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about the people who doubt. Average doubters are frequently worried about the future because they have serious doubts about themselves and the world. They start to look for a sure thing that will guarantee security. Anything from a marriage to a job to a belief system to a network of friends. They are the type that believes in saving for a rainy day and investing for the future and being loyal to a company in order to ensure their pensions. So on the good side, many doubters bought homes and apartments 20 years ago. So now they are financially far more secure because homes and apartments have more than doubled and tripled in value. So suddenly they're sitting on a nest egg. You know what they do? They think about, should I sell this house and go buy another house? That's what they think about all the time. Should I cash in? Should I not cash in? They think about, if I sell this, where would I go? How would I survive? On the good note, I must tell you that one day I was at a retirement home where there were people who had apartments in New York that they paid maybe $10,000 for that was suddenly worth something like $1 million. These are people who've owned these things for 40 years or a home or something, you know. And I saw in this retirement home, one after another were cashing in. They were selling their apartments. They were going to go rent somewhere because they would just figured suddenly they had $1 million and they were going to now enjoy the fruits of their lives. And they weren't worried about the security for the future. They just rent a place. They don't care if they paid $1,000 a month because they were going to live in their riches. And there was a whole bunch of them who had done just that. They weren't rich people because they earned a lot of money. They were rich people because they were afraid. But somehow, as you get older, very often your fears go away. Somehow, as you get older, some people get less and less frightened, you know, and they just say, ah, so what? What me worry? You know, what am I going to worry about? You know, it didn't happen up until now. Here I am, 70 years old, and that truck that I thought was going to fall from the sky did not happen. It didn't happen, so since I didn't get hurt, I'm going to get through life without having to protect myself anymore. So let's see what it's like. So I'll go out and I'll dance. You know, a lot of people who are this type don't dance. They're afraid of being judged and being evaluated. In fact, a lot of these people can very often don't even have their own voice. To that, when we get back from the break, I'm going to ask Naz Husseini to join us because I want to talk with her about how people, she's here in our offices, how people who are doubters manifest that doubt in their very voices, in the sound of their voice. If you listen on the radio, you can always hear a six. You can hear, you can always hear a doubter. You can hear them. You can hear them because they have trepidations. They can't project their voices. Or they project their voices in a certain kind of way. It's aggressive, but it's not necessarily all of them. Because remember, the basis of being such a doubter in the world is you believe you have no foundation. You believe there's no central core to you. You believe that unless you protect yourself, you're going to wind up like the kid from Cambodia. You're going to wind up lost in the world, and you're not going to know how to take care of yourself. So you protect yourself at every moment, and you protect, and you protect, and you protect. So what do you do about it? And it sometimes appears in different parts of you. It'll appear in your voice. When we get back, we'll talk about that. But if you're a doubter, you increasingly turn to safe bets. You try to find safe bets. Doing things the way that other people have done before is a feeling of weight and solidarity. Other people with traditions, you like that a lot, move ahead. Doubters will generally be hesitant to work for a company that has no track record. They don't do that. They want one that looks, even if it's promising but risky, they don't take that chance. They don't want to take chances. They want security, security, security. They tend to err in the side of caution, thus missing many possibilities for self-development. Yesterday we talked about luck, and one of the things about luck is that if you're a doubter too much, if you doubt too much, you never get a chance to take a shot at something, so luck often evades you. You live with fear, anxiety, and doubt instead, and you're always seeking support for independence. And looking for answers, And because they don't feel they could trust their own inner guidance, doubters often look for answers and ideas and insights first propounded by others. They do not jump on the bandwagon. They watch. They're skeptical. They doubt. They question. They're searching. But they're always resistant in some way. If you have somebody who's a doubter, you could show them the absolute, let's say you sell something you believe in. And I know this of one person who's a real estate salesperson. She loves to sell houses because she is an honest salesperson. She sells them absolutely perfectly. She gets to you. She tells you what the value is. She weighs everything all the ways, and she's not a shyster. She just believes in her product. So she comes to you, and she loves it. She loves connecting people to something they could buy within their range. She doesn't hustle at all. She's in a world where it's a real seller's economy, where the buyer is really looking for help. So then all of a sudden she'll present the perfect package to somebody, and they'll be ready to buy it. And then she runs into somebody who's a doubter, and they start checking everything. And they start checking it so much and checking it. And she says to me over and over again, I found them the perfect home. But while they were checking on whether there were termite eggs in the foundation and they didn't trust the first person they sent in, somebody else came along and bought the house over and over again. I know many of you are going to feel that regret. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little very special music for Jana, who's helping me in the studio today. We'll pull Naz Husseini in here to help us, talk about people and their voices. And some music from Michael, of course.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Ha ha ha!
That's a lover man, of all things. Talk about trust and distrust, huh? Lover Man by Cannonball Adderley, one of his club dates he did. It's on the album called The Definitive Cannonball Adderley. What's some old buddies in the background? But Miles Davis is back there on trumpet in the background. Also, Nat Adderley, his brother, and cornet. Quite a group of folks. All the kids that used to live on my block. Hey, look at that. Art Blakey, Milt Hinton, Paul Chambers, Wynton Kelly, Hank Jones. When I was a kid, you know, you could see all of these people in apartments. They would get together because there was no place to practice on 6th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. Many of them, but not all of them. I mean, Cannonball Adderley was not from New York. Hey, so we're talking about, in case you just tuned in, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind on WBAI 99.5 FM. If you haven't heard the entire program, or if you want to get it, you can always go to our website, thepositivemind.com, thepositivemind.com, and you could find archives. Also, you could go through the website of WBAI, WBAI.org, and it'll be in an archive. You can actually hear the program. If you don't have that capacity, you could always call us, and we could get you a copy of the program. So here are the points, and you could find us through the Internet, you know. Now, here are the points we talked about. We've been talking about doubt, mistrust, distrust. We're talking about people who are skeptical all the time. And now I want to ask Nas a question. Nas Husseini, who is a Gestalt therapist who works with me, and Nas does some interesting work using voices. You may have heard that during the one of the marathons we did. Nas, hi, welcome to WBAI. Let me see, where are we? There we go. Hi there.
Hi, Armand.
Nas, when a person, I was thinking about Cannonball Adderley, you know, and what makes Cannonball Adderley so great is not only the way he plays his saxophone, but because he has a kind of unlimited voice in it. You know, his voice has got no, he doesn't hold back. He trusts what he's going to play. I remember that with Charlie Parker also. Charlie Parker, he would make, there were sounds that Charlie Parker was making that nobody else had made before. He kind of played in between the lines. But he trusted his voice because that was the music he heard. It's like Picasso. You know, I remember Picasso and Steichen used to have a battle with each other because Steichen believed, you know, that if you see a photograph, you see a photograph of exactly what is, and he would criticize Picasso, and he said to Picasso, when you paint something, why do you paint something so distortedly? And Picasso said, I don't, that's the way I see it. And so he put himself out there, and he painted it just the way he saw it, but then Picasso, Steichen said, the photographer said, but no, when I take a photograph, you see exactly what is, and he reached in his pocket and pulled out a photograph of his wife. He said, look, Picasso, this is my wife. And Picasso said, small, isn't she? This is Armand DeMille with you. Nas.
Yes.
Nas. You can't, you know. Did you hear about the Buddhist...
Which one?
The Buddhist vacuum cleaner.
The Buddhist vacuum cleaner?
You didn't hear that, huh?
He was missing his core.
No, he just said it has no attachments. Hey, Nas.
Yeah.
People in their voices, hesitant voices... You know, and I hear it. I mean, I hear it all the time. I hear it in people, especially people who are protesting. You know, they're not effective. They're not effective because their voice doesn't project. Mm-hmm. And the voice doesn't project because it's hesitant. What do you find with this? You being both a therapist, trained in psychology, trained in Gestalt therapy, and in voice.
Mm-hmm. I find the voice very telling in therapy, also in life, as you're saying. It's projection as well as timing, you know, that is a way that people hesitate when they're doubting themselves, when they don't trust their voice. And so the voice can be held out by being very quiet, by being very thin in texture, by being chopped up and stopped so that it's like putting your foot on the brake and the accelerator.
Could
of the
you
car.
Give me examples of those?
Well,
an example of talking. Okay, we know talking quiet and
quietly,
talking in a whisper. Okay.
Yeah, holding back. In terms
but
of
wait,
texture.
Wait, I want to talk about that.
All
because
right.
What you did when you said talking quietly, you whispered. But it's not just the whisper. I mean, I know people who...
I had some tonality. It was a soft tonality down here.
There it is. So it's more like, you know, let me see if I can bring my voice there. It's like, hey, everybody, welcome to WBAI. This is Armand DeMille with you. Well, no, it sounds nice and soft. I must be, you know.
And small.
It sounds small.
Yeah, I'm seeing a mouse instead of an elephant. You know, I see a smaller image of a person or a more faded color. You know, it's like not in living
muted
color.
So if you want to be not very visible, if you want to be not very visible, this is where you would talk.
Yeah.
Oh, you know who does that? You know, you get that a lot. You get that a lot on your the directional things that are in cars that tell you which way to turn. The ones that are voice activated, they have voices that kind of disappear. You know, now you can turn right at the next corner.
Fade out. Well, it can be an intimate voice, the quiet voice, but when you're trying to project or trying to get something done or trying to express an idea, if the volume drops down and people are straining to hear you, it's not making a very strong statement. Yeah.
So hesitant voice, what is a hesitant voice like?
A hesitant voice could happen texturally, it could happen pace-wise. So texturally, it might take out the fullness of there's more air in there than there is sound. So that breaks up the fluidity of that music we were listening to. It just flowed. It was full. It was rich. So it's taking out that presence.
Show me it.
I'm trying to show you a more, texturally hesitant voice, and I'm also stopping and starting. So timing-wise, stopping and starting the voice also is a way of hesitating.
Almost like you're thinking between the words.
And censoring.
And censoring.
Yeah.
Censoring is very important.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What so, are the kind you of know, work? Goodness, for, you know, if I don't want to make a mistake and say something that'll put me at risk in some way. So everything is halting so that I can make sure before, you know, I proceed.
You know, I frequently have met social phobics who have that kind of hesitant voice. Now it makes a lot more sense because what they're doing is they're afraid of being embarrassed, which is a common thing with social phobic people who are social phobic. They don't want to be embarrassed, so the hesitancy kind of makes sense because they're censoring out, not saying something they think they should be saying. Okay, what about people who talk too loud?
Well, sounds like a way to push others away or to create the illusion of taking up a lot of space so that they can feel powerful.
You know, I was at a place recently where I heard somebody talking at a restaurant, and I know they weren't drunk, and I know I'm going to try to do this without blasting the microphone. They were saying, well, you know, it was like they were disembodied. It was like they weren't in their body. It was like they had a microphone at 100 feet away, and they turned up the volume on the speaker, and the person who was talking was the speaker with the volume turned up. Well, you know, I'm not really sure if that's exactly what I want to do. And they would talk with this loudness, but it wasn't confidence. And it wasn't, I don't think it was meant. I think it was like they possessed a body that wasn't theirs. It's like they were the voice-activated system. Have you heard that in people?
I have, and I'm also getting another image from that, which is not only not owning their body, but not really being in the context they're in. So if someone's standing 3 feet away from them and they're talking to 10 feet away, it's kind of obliterating who's there. It's not acknowledging.
So it's more you're talking as if... you're not there. You're talking as if you're not a part of the situation at the moment. You're talking from a distance.
You could say that way too. Yeah, you're in the football field instead of the restaurant.
Interesting.
Yeah. So those are some of the ways in which people can hesitate in their voices. And so what they're demonstrating is that they don't trust their voice, that, you know, that my voice is not there for me, that I can't just open my mouth and whatever comes out, it'll be fine, or it'll be what it is. It may be a squeak, it may be a squawk, it may be whatever, and it's okay. And in therapy, it's one way that we work with that, is that we bring attention and consciousness to what the voice does sound like, or I work that way, and that begins, if a client starts to use their voice in a more connected way, then they can start to feel connected to themselves and trust themselves. So trust your voice, trust yourself, and over time, trusting yourself and daring to make a sound leads to trusting that, you know, your life, everything.
Is it like giving vocal lessons?
Not exactly. You know,
it sounds like it. I mean, if you go to a speech teacher, that's what they teach you to do.
Mm-hmm. It can be in moments. It can look like a voice or a vocal lesson in a particular instance, but it doesn't have to be. It could be during a regular therapy session, there might be a moment where, did you hear your voice? What did it sound like? I felt like I was choking on it. Okay, listen to it again. Breathe. Now try making a sound with more breath. Or how does it feel to choke on your voice? What does that bring up for you? So that would be a little bit less like a vocal lesson and more like using the voice in the context of therapy.
There are people I know who say, you know, they like my voice on the radio, but they say that they hate their voice.
Mm-hmm.
How do you account for somebody hating their voice?
That can happen in so many ways. I mean, for one thing, it's hard to believe how many people have been told that they don't sound good.
That's true.
Don't sing in the chorus, just mouth the words, you know. And also, you know, if someone spoke and they were cut off, say as a child, they weren't allowed to make a sound, maybe a loud sound wasn't accepted, maybe an angry sound, maybe a coquettish sound, whatever range they might have experimented with, different parents might have had discomfort with parts of their range, and they might have shown disapproval just from the sound without consciously knowing that it was the sound that was irritating them, and so that they might censor those kinds of sounds, so that people wind up being in a very small range of sound just because certain parts of their range have become taboo.
Hmm. Boy, this is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. So when you listen to people speak, do you analyze their voices in your own mind? Do you look at, like, you know, if you're a dentist and you look at people, I wonder if dentists say, how many caps does he have? What kind of metal fillings? You know, they automatically analyze you when they look at your teeth. You think they do? You think a dentist can't help it? Does a voice specialist listen to every voice? Do you automatically hear them, Naz?
I don't always focus on it. If I did, I would not be listening all the time to what else is going on. So if I'm not working with a client, I might tune that out. But there are certain voices that I'm very sensitive to, and then I will notice that.
What kind of voice are you very sensitive to?
Very loud voices, the example you gave. Voices that hammer, like a sledgehammer, like they're unrelenting. Yeah.
So that's, do it again, but do it a little softer.
I'll stand back from the microphone. You know, like the talking is relentless.
Let me see. How does that really manifest? I know. It sounds like a machine gun. I wanted to tell you that I'm going to... like that.
Kind of breathless,
and it's like it's constant. It's coming at you. And when you listen to those voices, you don't hear... You don't hear the content anymore because,
yeah,
I got it. Well, so what people do is they actually have you're lucky. I mean, clients are lucky. People who see you as a therapist are very lucky because they can get a chance to work both on regular therapy and they get a chance to use their voice as an identifier.
Yes, and your voice is something you take with you everywhere, so you can always be getting more in touch with it and getting more in touch with yourself through it.
Sometimes I leave my voice behind. You see, sometimes, and it's happened to me, you know, I'll get in a taxi cab, and one time I was in a taxi cab, and there was a guy playing a tape of mine from one of my radio programs in his truck. And so I pull up next to the truck, and there's my voice over there. That's a nice, odd experience. I hear myself talking from the truck.
Out of body experience.
And I said that's familiar. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with a Positive Mind. Free. There's a place called the Gestalt Center, right?
Yes.
And you're doing a free, and this better not be for charge because we don't announce for charge.
No, it's free. Fifth Avenue.
Introduction on what? On Gestalt or on voice work?
No, it's on Gestalt therapy. What is Gestalt therapy for people who want to know what it is?
And you're not going to sign anybody up?
Well, they can find out what the training program is and see if it's for them.
I guess there's always some little catch with free things, but are they going to get a chance to experience their voice stuff?
It's I don't know about voice, but it's very experiential, so it'll be body experience. They'll hear about it, they'll try out an experiment, and they'll hear about the program.
GESTALT Center, Gestalt Center, Naz Husseini, Hussaini?
It's Hosseini.
Oh, that's very close.
Yes.
Hosseini.
Hosseini.
Hosseini, who's going to be at the Gestalt Center, the free Sunday from 4 to 6 o'clock. How nice. If anybody goes there from WBAI, introduce yourself to Naz.
Definitely.
You know, introduce yourself and say, I heard you on the radio station. Hey, listen, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. I wish I had more time to take calls. I'm so excited because there's so much about this distrust and trust that came to my mind. I was thinking about email, cell phones, internet use, the use of privacy. This whole idea of privacy is different. At first, people used to sneak phone calls to each other. You know, you sneak a little phone call, you pick up your cell phone. Now, your cell phone has a record. So your husband, your wife, your father, your mother, they could pick up your phone and they could find out who you called. And more, there is evidence being presented by a person saying, and who is this phone number you called over and over again? And it's on the phone bills, too. So there's more of a record than there was before. So if you're somebody who is a doubter, you've now got more fuel, you know, you're checking bills. And I hope I'm not giving any people ideas. Because, you know, even though it sounds like the real doubt here is about infidelity, there's a lot more doubt that people have. If you're a doubter, you worry about more than that. You worry about how much time the person, who's your kid talking to? Who are they calling up? Email is the same thing. Email, which looks like it's free, you know, I mean, it's public record. You have email, and you can now check on email. If the government wants, I'm not trying to get you crazy with it, but here, where you think you have more privacy, which is the privacy of an email between you and somebody you care about, the privacy of a cell phone conversation between you and somebody you know, it's become far more public. As well it should be. You know, as maybe that's okay. Maybe you should never say anything that you're afraid somebody's going to overhear. You know, I don't like gossip because I always think there's a rule I have about gossip. If somebody comes over and says to me, don't tell Naz, but, you know, I'd rather they didn't tell me because I want them to tell Naz if they're going to talk about Naz. But you see, people who are doubters are always trying to gather an army. And the way they gather an army is by telling stories about people. You know, I heard he takes a shower and wears army boots. You know, I mean things like that. And they'll just, you know, they'll try to get doubt about a person. So here they are. They especially do it if they feel that they admire somebody. The more a doubter admires someone, the more he's going to be talking badly about him. Because in some way you want to trust him, and in another way you want to kind of get as much away from it as possible, because you're always caught in that position. I desperately need to trust and love somebody and have somebody love me on one hand. On the other hand, I'm terribly afraid that they will overwhelm me. If I let myself love them, I'm afraid they'll take me over. So it becomes a problem. The other thing about it is this thing called that if you're a doubter, you're always escaping, you know, in some way. And one of the ways that they escape, this is the kind of kid that if you catch a kid doing something and you say, did you hit your sister? No, the door slammed and it hit my sister. And then they do this thing. Whenever you accuse somebody who's a doubter, they say, and by the way, she was upstairs looking through your drawer. See, they get you to shift the field off them as fast as possible because they're very afraid of being accused, very afraid of being caught for the very same reason. They're afraid they're going to be thrown out in the street alone. So privacy may seem like it's something you get more and more of, but you get less and less privacy, and perhaps you should live your life, if possible, in a way that has no privacy in it. Maybe you should just have an open life, you know, so you don't have to worry about it. But, of course, that would be anathema to somebody who is a doubter and wants to keep everything private. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. So I think one of the things that we might be able to do is to understand a little more and to try to get it. I want you to understand that the person who is the doubter, who is a skeptic, is somebody who does this all the time. They develop an extraordinary sensitivity to danger signals. They are out there and they're trying to tell you that they're right and that this is the way they should be. All I say to you is keep this in mind. They need to be touched. They need to be held, but they don't need to be held too closely, because if you hold them too closely, they run away. So I say the following. If you see somebody who's a perennial doubter and they're always a skeptic, you know, if they're not crazy, I mean, if they're not really off the edges, touch them. Touch them. Put your hand on them somewhere, on their shoulder, on their arm, and say, I understand. I understand how frightened you are. I understand. Give them a little softness. On the other hand, be real careful not to give them any sense of overwhelming them, because they are so easily overwhelmed. They are so easily afraid that they could get that affection could lead to some kind of trap. You know? Hey, no more time. I'm sorry, Naz. Thanks for being with us today.
Armand.
And Jana, thanks for helping us out here in the studio. Good to say hello. Michael wants to say hello to you. You didn't even hear it. Say it again.
Hi, Michael. It's Jana.
Hi, Jana. Thank you so much. I spent a very lovely time with Jana last Thursday when you brought down the Positive Mind for that day, and I just want you to know you're welcome anytime in the studios, okay?
Thank you, Michael. That
All
was
right.
fun. I had a good time.
Happy New Year.
Thanks. Same to you.
Okay, and we're going to be going, my friends, and we'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., and I'm going to be talking about more stuff. That's more of Cannibal Adderall. And